We are back. You're listening to WKCR 99.9 The Edge. That was another 8 in a row mega rock block of Led Zeppelin. This is the Morning Zoo Crew. I'm Will Madman Meniker, and with me, as always, is Felix Boomer Biederman and Matt the Animal Christman.
Who's today's dumbass of the week?
I think it was me because I let the hulkster fuck my wife.
We are brought. Who? Bong? Bong? We are brought. We are broadcasting live from TJ O'Hallahan's, the one by the airport, not the one in the mall.
Yeah, that one's still closed after the murders.
It's the Woke Zoo Crew, guys. It's the Woke Zoo Crew, and we're back.
I
That
hear a
was.
lot of people out there doing misogynoir. Boing.
At the bottom of the hour, we're giving away tickets to see the Bell Hooks lecture live at the Rochester Speedway.
We got Roxanne Gay calling in to do smash, pash, or condemn.
Later on, we're going to have some cis white males in the studio, and we're going to teach them about privilege.
Yes. No, it's us again. It's episode 2 of the Chapo Trap House. As I already said, I'm Will. I'm back. And I'm here again with Felix and Matt. What's been going on, guys? How are you?
I'm good. It's a little cold, but irregardless, as I like to say, that's the correct one. We're here to talk about the postmortem of Super Threesday, or as America's most accurate pundit Carl Daigle calls it, Super Toesday. I'm not really sure why he's doing that, but he seems to have an obsession there. And everything else we have for you this week.
Matt, do you have a good week?
I did, yeah. I'm gonna get ready to take a road trip to get back in touch with the real heart of America and understand why the slovenly peons of this nation don't get jobs.
We're going to talk about that. I had an okay week. I was a little depressed, but I've been spending a lot of quality time with my good friend Hieronymus Bosch. No, not the painter, Harry Bosch, the
Wait a minute.
LAPD
Wait, wait,
homicide
wait.
detective.
Are you telling me that there's a cop who's named after a Renaissance Dutch painter?
It seems odd, but that is true. That is his name. He goes by Harry, but the name on the birth certificate is Hieronymus Bosch. He plays by his own rules. He has a weird name, but he gets justice done. So
It sounds like he has adventures that I'd like to check out.
it's available on Amazon, streaming now, season 2. And Daredevil is back. So I started it out very depressed this week, for reasons we'll discuss. But now I'm back. Now I'm feeling better because all my stories are keeping me company.
It's not about how many times you get knocked down. It's about how many times you get back up. And if a cop who only answers to his own rules helps you back up, that ain't nothing to be ashamed of.
Not at all. So, I guess first off, it was our first show last week, so I want to thank everyone who listened and shared the good news on social media. We really appreciate it. But on last week's show, I got to be honest with you, we were free balling, folks. We were basically going commando for that whole hour and a half or so. But this week, I've made a conscious attempt to sort of slip a nice pair of boxer briefs on this free balling conversation and impose a little bit of order. So to that end, we have prepared a juicy slate of topics that we're going to get into of the news that happened this week. And then we're going to hopefully transition into a broader topic in the second half. We're going to discuss Hamilton, the greatest musical ever.
How did a bastard, orphan, child of a whore and a Scotsman. Sorry, I'll stop.
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, it's been running through my head all week. We're going to get to there. But first, we want to just let's take you through the hot takes of the week. So I think we got to start with Super Threesday, Super Tuesday, the election news, which
More like Super Turdsday, in my opinion. It was not good.
no, it was not good at all. This is why I was so depressed this week, basically, because basically all the fun is over in this election. Like all of the beautiful characters, all of the funny storylines, they're all done now. I mean, I guess like the there is still the one ember that is still glowing is the possibility of something truly insane happening at the Republican convention, which I think it probably will. But other than that, it's pretty much it's all over, folks.
Yeah, because now I have to like follow this horse race shit for a job. We were watching it closely, and we think that there's a very good likelihood of a brokered convention if John Kasich wins Ohio, which of course he did. And I would just like to point out at the last debate before the third Super Tuesday that all three of the four candidates said we don't want a brokered convention; it's bad for the party. And Kasich, whose actual campaign strategy is the old homeless guy scam of parking your shopping cart in front of a McDonald's and saying, you cannot enter this restaurant unless you give me a dollar. He was like, well, I'm actually kind of banking on a brokered convention. And he fucking got it. He got it.
Yeah. You know, I was re-listening to last week's show, and in that show, I sort of opened up a valve of my heart to the possibility of hope for dear, sweet, beautiful Bernie Sanders. And I shan't be making that mistake again.
Don't ever believe anything again.
Yeah, believe it or not.
It's done. I'm looking at our little our list of topics. You know, I'm letting you in on the secret behind the magic. But one of the topics, Matt, you wrote down Super Tuesday and the advent of hell on earth, which I
yeah.
I mean, there's a good chance that, you know, like I said, the fun is over, and there's a good chance that we are witnessing the inauguration of the apocalypse, basically.
Yeah, I can't wait to watch the debates this fall when like Donald Trump is accusing Hillary Clinton of like murder and looking like a, you know, a frump, which are equally horrible crimes in his mind. And she's just like, she's just like gesturing to the moderator being like, this is just outrageous. That'll be really fun.
I don't know what causes more blood. What comes out of her pussy created in Benghazi. Mr. Trump, I just have to say that I may not be Zoe Deschanel, but I will be the new girl.
I want Hillary to say, well, I know one thing about Mr. Trump. Young Metro does not trust you. I let myself feel a little bit of hope after Michigan. I thought, you know, that came out of nowhere. Man, he could really win some of these upper Midwestern states, these big upper Midwestern states. But that didn't happen. He didn't even win Missouri, which he was leading. Hillary ended up winning it by like a razor thin, like half a percentage point or something.
Yeah, he was he was winning until he lost.
Brutal. Yeah, it's just like I said. It's just not fun anymore because both of the trains are pretty much on the track, and they're both heading just straight to November. And the trains are not so much on the track as they're on Cormac McCarthy's The Road, because I'm pretty certain that's the terminus of our American political system right now. So that's where we're headed, folks.
I want to give a shout out to all the people who doubted me in Virgil, Texas, calling Illinois so confidently for Trump. Nate Silver, of course, said that he wasn't sure Trump was going to win Illinois because he thought he would lose in Cook County. His reasoning being that Chicago white people just aren't racist enough.
Wow, Nate, dropping the ball.
Yeah,
Nate.
It's a pretty good bet that like that big city white people are like the racistest people on earth.
Brutally racist. Like don't let Chicago people's accents fool you. Yeah, I want 1,000 years of blood and my blood's on the soil here. The Turk lust for Vienna.
Oh, well, you know. Again, like just tallying up the results, it was grim and depressing. But I don't know. There's just not much interest there in that story, except for the fact that Matt, you attended a Trump rally this week, right?
Yeah, I
got some on the ground reporting for you guys.
Yeah, I literally was, and it was raining that day, so I was not going to do it. But then I thought of the trap house, and I made myself go.
where was it?
So here's the thing. So this was the Sunday after the Friday shit show in Chicago.
Yeah.
When everyone's like, oh God, it's 1932 again. The streets are going to run red with blood. Blah blah blah, and. The first news, because he had had a scheduled Cincinnati speech, and then it was on the news anyway, that day, canceled. They said it had been canceled. But then Trump tweeted, the reports that the Cincinnati rally are canceled are false. That's baloney. We'll be there. So I was like, oh, shit, yes, because I figured it was going to be like, the downtown thing in Cincinnati, Chicago, and I live downtown, and I was figuring anywhere it was going to be, I would be able to walk right there. I thought, oh, fantastic. But then I found out that there had been basically a change of venue. It was scheduled to be at the big convention center downtown, like the 10,000-seat convention center that's literally two blocks from my house. So that would have been perfect. But that's downtown. A city that's about almost 50% African American, they're probably pissing themselves at the prospect of that after Friday. So they moved it way the hell out to some meeting center in Westchester, which is a wealthy white flight suburb almost 20 miles north of the city.
Sounds exactly like the Westchester in New York.
So what's so funny about it is, like, we're not canceling the Cincinnati. We're not scared. We're not canceling the Cincinnati thing. We're just moving to, the mayonnaise belt that surrounds Cincinnati. And it's like, bitch, you're shook. Just admit it. Shook, and you couldn't take downtown. Just accept it. So
going forward, Trump will have to avoid most major urban centers.
He's
going to
stay,
right?
He's going to stay. And the thing is, like, those people are his people. They're mad that they can't go downtown because they're scared or whatever. Whatever fantasies that are in their head that keep them from going to the touring productions of Broadway musicals that they would like to see, if only they weren't scared that someone's going to take their car or someone was going to ask them for money, which would be the most traumatizing moment of their life. and they're like, God, Trump's going to fix this shit. He's going to let me go see Grease, starring the cast of American Idol. And I'm not going to have to worry about some hobo asking me for $5.
So you ended up going. I mean, like, what was the scene like?
So it was rainy, but the commitment was something to see. But we got there 2 hours ahead of time, and we were all, and the parking around it was all full, and we were walking. A friend and I went, and we were walking to the place. And before we even got near the building, there was a cop there directing traffic who told people. Like, they gave way more – you had to register ahead of time, but they said – they gave way more tickets. They basically gave tickets to anybody who registered, and the thing only held, like, 1,200 people. So people who were there getting in line 2 hours ahead of time were not going to get in. Like, he was just telling people that. And some of them got despondent and left, but others of them just kept going. I guess they – the hope beats eternal in the human breast to see a giant orange monster scream at them. So we and I, my friend and I were like, but we could see there was a big group in front of the building, so we decided to check it out even if we didn't figure we were going to wait in line. So we get there, and the front of the building has this huge line going down just to the point where you can't even see it because it's bending around through parking lots and stuff. And then there's like a group of people who aren't in line milling around in front of this sort of very loose police cordon, on the other side of which, in this like little muddy auxiliary parking lot, are maybe 100 protesters.
So there were protesters there.
There were. There were about 100 of them. A nice mix of young Muslims and Black Lives Matter activists and college students and vapers. Not kidding. There was a guy in the front line with a giant vape pen. And a girl in a Pikachu costume. And
are you sure they weren't waiting for like the Pokemon convention that was canceled?
They might have been. Yeah. They were wet and confused. It was very peaceful. It was not like anything you read about what happened in Chicago, because like there were only a few cops there, but there was like a yellow police tape, and nobody messed with the police tape. They stayed on their sides. And there was
The key about that is what you read about Chicago, because let's be honest, Chicago was not violent either.
Oh, no, it wasn't violent.
It was just, I mean, it was some, loud. I mean, this, it was it was violent by the standards of, like, you know, the, you know, like the babies who...
Of Michael Barbaro.
Yeah. Oh,
I wonder why people like Michael Barbaro or Damon Linker saw pictures of Chicago and instantly got terrified.
Yeah.
I'm wondering here.
But, I mean, even if it wasn't violent...
Well, their pants...
Look at those. Those pants are nearly on the ground. That's violence. I mean, even if there wasn't violence in Chicago, for the most part, there was, like, really intimate yelling, like, right, mm-hmm, like, right, getting each other's face. That was there was, like, a little court, there was, like, a little muddy, like, no man's land between them, and people stayed on either side of it. And basically, it was just chanting and counter-chanting. The protesters were going through all the classics, this is what democracy looks like, and, you know, build bridges, not walls, that kind of stuff. And for the most part, the pro-Trump people, who were just a terrifying collection of just unnervingly well manicured, for the most part, sort of suburban thrill seekers, and a couple of terrifying looking like survivalist types, for the most part, they were just sort of chuckling, and occasionally they would do a build the wall chant, but that was about it. And the main thing I just noticed is, you know, you read these reports of people talking about Trump supporters. These people are desperate. These people are angry. These people are confused and terrified, you know. And that's probably true, but this crowd that he got to go to this thing in the White Flight Tony White Flight suburb outside of Cincinnati, these people were very comfortable and incredibly smug. It was just these, like, they were laughing for the most part at the protesters. They thought it was funny. They weren't like, this is the soul of America's on the line. I mean, for the most part, they were amused, and they were very. You could tell it was like a fun. It was a fun time for them. It was a chance for them to sort of, just like let their hair down. And there were a lot of terrifying Patrick Batemans in waiting. You know,
I mean, isn't this similar to sort of how like when the Tea Party was discussed in the media? And I feel like on both left and right, it was very self-serving in a lot of ways to present the Tea Party as like. Like it's sort of in the same light that they were mostly sort of a lower class of kind of like confused, angry rubes, but like actual like you know political or social science, like the studies of the Tea Party members or people who are active found that they were actually college educated, almost universally college educated and quite well off.
Oh yeah, and the thing is like those working class of Trump supporters are there. It's just I don't think they go to those kind of events, and I think not, it's sort of like a plus situation. It's people want to think of it as either or. People want to think Trump supporters are either these sort of, you know, smug suburban, relatively well-off people who just have these aesthetic cultural issue concerns, people who want to just be politically incorrect for once, you know, versus truly displaced and economically unsettled. Working class white people, and I think it's both in this case. Because mm-hmm. If you look at like the correlations for where Trump voting is, you know the things that correlate strongest are shit like you know white people with no college, no high school degree, and things like that. So it's definitely both, and I think like the composition of rallies and stuff is going to fluctuate depending a lot on geography.
Mm.
That's the weird X factor that I've noticed in Trump is, I mean, it sounds fucking ridiculous to say because it is. Trump, if you take out all his racism, is like a moderate Republican.
Oh, yeah. He wants to maintain social services and stuff like that, yeah.
Yeah, he's to the left of John Kasich on every fucking issue except for open racism. And so you see him, like in Massachusetts, he wins with people with postgraduate degrees, and he destroys in New Hampshire, which is, you know, typically where that type of Republican wins. But... also, like, Kentucky, I remember a lot of people were calling Kentucky for Cruz before it happened, and I said, no, like, all the Appalachians are going to vote for Trump. That's his coalition. His coalition is just, you know, sort of like smug white people who would have voted for, would have voted for, like, George H.W. Bush happily, and are just, like, a little less squeamish than Rubio voters, who are the biggest pussies on earth. And, like, just really pissed off white people.
Yeah, it's like a guy who, you know, has lost four jobs in the last 3 years and then like a guy who owns a car dealership chain and is sick of his grandkids telling him not to do racist jokes at Thanksgiving.
Yeah, and that's a winning coalition in America.
It really is. It's like it's that top low coalition that's sort of a dark mirror image of the one Obama put together in 2008. You know,
yeah. Or it's AKP. Trump is American Erdogan that we finally leader with honor.
God damn it! I've been waiting.
Matt, did you now did you do any like sort of like Thomas Friedman style talking to any of these people? Did they like confirm your already deeply held beliefs, or did you speak to anyone?
Well, I did. I took some video and some. I did a little bit of a stand up Periscope, my first journalistic foray. For the most part, though, I just listened to them talk to each other because I thought that was pretty instructive.
Yeah. So what were they? What
and
was
partially because I'm a pussy, and it was like it was that close to the Friday fracas, right. And you know I didn't want to get punched. But like the main thing they kept saying was like it was heaping disdain on the protesters, there was also a couple like they would do a Black Lives Matter chant, they do an All Lives Matter chant, that kind of thing. But mostly the dominant sentiment was the reason that they weren't annoyed by these people, it seemed to me, is that they were like bone deep convinced that they were all illegal aliens who couldn't vote.
Okay.
Like, I kept hearing that over and over again, like, oh, you can't even vote. Ah. And I heard there was this one brilliant, exchange between these two dudes, one of whom, looked like he might've been a contestant on Ink Master. And another one who looks like he has a sign at his like dry goods store that says, you know, no more than two teens at a time. And one of them is just going like, oh, yeah, those are illegal. They can't vote anyway. And he's like, oh, yeah, but they'll let them vote, you know. And he goes, oh, they're liberals. They can do whatever they want. So, and then the other one goes, that's what they think. So...
Well, the Pikachu costume, almost certainly from Japan. I don't know what they're doing in this country.
Yeah, one of them was yelling about how Squirtle is vastly superior.
Well, this actually, so you got up close and personal with the Trump voter.
Yeah.
And this is a perfect segue because another person who got up close and personal with the Trump coalition this week was Kevin D. Williamson of the National Review.
Do you have a Dracula music drop?
I'm just going to edit in some organ music. Yeah, exactly. Sorry, this is another segue aside. Whenever I see Kevin D. Williamson, I always think of General Jack D. Ripper from Dr. Strangelove.
I think about him sucking on D's nuts.
So this piece got a lot of burn this week, and it basically boils down to Kevin Williamson wants poor white Americans to pull their damn pants up.
I know we're going to really tear into this, but can I just say my favorite central conceit of Kevin Williamson's piece, where he shits all over, like, Appalachians and poor white Midwesterners and, you know, like, the American white underdog.
All of them. He goes from upstate New York, Appalachia, Texas.
Everywhere.
Yeah, all – if there's white trash somewhere, he's taking a big old shit on them.
So I want to say my favorite conceit of it is that he's like, well, yeah, why don't you be more like me, a massive success? It's like, we're going to fucking – like, the National Review is as much of a welfare institution as, like, any of these think tanks.
Oh, my God. Yeah, absolutely.
Like, you're not rich. You're fucking nobody. You're a fucking asshole who wears an opera cape and, like, reviews movies for...
He started out as the theater critic for the National Review, and now I always see him referred to as their roving correspondent. He's always referred to himself and in National Review's press as the roving correspondent, because I guess he's the only one that actually, like, travels places to write about them.
Well, I mean, they call him the roving correspondent because Peeping Tom.
I love the idea that they, like, pay his expenses to cross the country to give different, like, simian descriptions of different black people. It's like... Here, we're gonna send you to Ferguson so you can call everybody monkeys.
Kevin Williamson if you guys haven't seen him, he looks like fat Anton LaVey, or he looks like I called him Cold Stone Steve Austin. but he's like, no one respects him. No one, not even like, even like John Bedoras, who's a fucking dumb oaf himself. He's like, just is like,
by the way,
he has to be friends with this guy. And he looks like he goes into Forever 21 with mirrors on his shoes. but he's painting himself as like, why can't they be more like me?
Matt, yeah, you called him a gay Dracula.
I mean, gay Dracula.
I called him a fatter, gayer Anton LaVey. But here's a little Chapo Trap House secret for the listeners. Whenever we talk about these people, you can't get the full effect until you Google image search them. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. If you read these National Review guys or really any of them, you're missing out on half the fun. Because if you can imagine their face and what they look like when you're reading it, it demystifies the whole thing.
Yeah, it's like if, you know, they say you're supposed to, like, sync up Dark Side of the Moon and Wizard of Oz. Sync up the Trap House to, like, Google image searches of any of the people we're talking about. It really enhances the experience. Drugs.
Yeah, I want to read this is a paragraph in the Kevin Williamson article that probably raised the most eyebrows. So I'm going to read from the D-Man right now. Quote, if you spend time in hardscrabble white upstate New York or eastern Kentucky or my own native West Texas, and you take an honest look at the welfare dependency, the drug and alcohol addiction, the family anarchy, which is to say, the whelping of human children with all the respect and wisdom of a stray dog, you will come to an awful realization. It wasn't Beijing. It wasn't even Washington, as bad as Washington can be. It wasn't immigrants from Mexico, excessive and problematic as they also may be. It wasn't any of that. These people did it to themselves. So now I think, like, it shouldn't really surprise anyone that the National Review has turned on poor white people with this level of vehemence, but I guess it's just noteworthy because now Kev is finally talking about poor white people the way he talks about all black people, which is just to compare them to animals.
It's just such a breathtaking move because it just shows the underlying, like, ferocious commitment to, you know, ideology that transcends every even just basic, like, common sense, because, you know, these guys have this idea of, you know, capitalism is liberating, and as you know, as a force for human thriving, the greatest one in the world, and all that. But like, what has been the result of sort of allowing capitalism a greater degree of freedom in the last 30 years? It's been the creation of these just absolutely failed communities. And when it was just when that was conceived of in racial terms only, they were able to explain that disparity by saying, well, you know, they're black, and, you know, the Derbyshire types might decide
they can use the cultural explanation.
Right, yeah. I mean, like, you could either be hardcore Derbyshire and say, yeah, you know, their skulls aren't shaped correctly, or you can go to Evan D. Williamson and just a slightly more acceptable version of the same thing, which is, well, you know, it's the culture. And either way, it explains away this thing. Now you have these massive communities that have completely been destroyed, where you can't break out your calipers to explain why. And then instead of, like, reckoning with the fact that, oh, capitalism has been massively dislocating for people, and that even just as importantly, that poverty is traumatizing to people, that generational poverty is deeply traumatizing to your ability to function in myriad ways. I mean, we have plenty of science for that. That can't be the case, you know? If that's the case, then the intervention is required. But so instead of confronting that, even though the race theory doesn't hold, they basically invented a thing where these white people are different than the other white people. And, like, that doesn't...
And that it's their fault entirely because they've failed capitalism not as an economic system, but as a moral one.
Yeah. And the thing, and like the cultural, because they can't rely on race science because these people are white, unless they want to go back. And this might happen. These guys might go back to like 19th century classifications.
I mean, let's be honest, a lot of rural Appalachia are Scotch-Irish.
Right, and like they're going to put out an article in the National Review like, well, you know what? We have to revise the definition of white people. They don't count anymore. We were wrong in our previous estimations.
Well, you said the effects of capitalism over the last 30, 40 years or so have been massively dislocated and created these deeply sort of like just barren and kind of like desiccated communities. Kevin's solution to all this is even more dislocation. And yeah. If you make it to the end of the article, basically he says, these communities need to be destroyed. They have to be basically raised, and the people have to be forced to move. He said they need U-Haul, is the phrase he uses at the end. And so it's basically back to this idea that there's no hope in any of these communities. There's no future for any of the people who live there. So the only way to fix it is just to move, is just to get these people to move. Now, the first problem with that is these people don't have the money to move in the first place. So who's going to buy them the U-Haul? I mean, certainly not the government, right? I assume that isn't...
Well, Marco Rubio had... That was part of his, like, reformicon agenda, is that he had this idea for subsidizing moving expenses to jobs. But, okay. Like, you know, I love the idea of, like, a bunch of people... moving to a nearby city because what? There was a Craigslist ad for a job, and they're all going to go to the local government office and like fill out paperwork to get reimbursed for their U-Haul.
Oh, it's a shame we missed out on Rubio tent cities.
Well, yeah, I mean that's the thing. It's like the vision for this is basically he wants to turn America into like the Judge Dredd world, where there's like
well, you described it as medieval England.
And then the rest of the country is completely depopulated.
Yeah, you described it as medieval England. It's just like these like large swaths of the country that have just been like abandoned to just banditry. And
It'll be a lot of fun when it's like, oh, we're going to do a road trip. If our car breaks down, we'll probably be murdered by bandits.
That would be hilarious because if you know anything about any of the NRO writers, it seems like their cars always break down. They always get caught in elevators. They always get stuck on monorails. So,
fix
that. John Podoritz would be caught in Appalachia and roasted like a pig.
That might make it worth it.
But Podoritz would never go to Appalachia in the first place. I'm more worried about Kev in this situation.
Yeah, Kev, the roving correspondent, on his way to like figure out if lesser people have lesser age of consent laws in West Virginia.
Now, okay, so. This story got like you know was considered very controversial and like a lot of people on the right like sort of didn't like it because I guess he was saying the loud part quiet and the quiet part loud. But one person who came to his defense that I want to mention briefly is his colleague David French of the National Review. Again, Google image search him right now. He looks like a weaker, more evil James Cromwell. David French, his colleague, wrote a piece defending Kevin Williamson. The title of the piece was Working Class Whites Have Moral Responsibilities, a Defense of Kevin Williamson. And in the piece, he relates a hilarious story that I think is very telling. I just want to read from it here. Quote, he says, "As I've related before, my church in Kentucky made a determined effort to reach kids and families that were falling between the cracks. And it was consistently astounding how little effort most parents and their children made to improve their lives. If they couldn't find a job in a few days, or perhaps even as little as a few hours, they'd stop looking. If they got angry at teachers or coaches, they'd drop out of school. If they fought with their wife, they had sex with a neighbor. And always, always, there was a sense of entitlement." And what I love so much about this is like his church group is trying to reach out to these Cletuses and Lurleens in rural Kentucky, and it's like it's the exact mirror image of like the clueless lib who wants to like teach inner city kids in Chicago how to meditate or start a recycling program in the Gaza Strip or something.
Yeah, I like I know that we always go back to Lebanon here. I read that too, and the I tried nature of it. It's all the NRO guys and all the like intellectual conservatives, as they like to be called. They're the Maronites. They're Peter Dow 30 years ago, because
They've totally given up now. They've totally given up on the rest of the country, and they're fine keeping these enclaves, like in Washington, D.C., where Marco Rubio wins by a landslide against Ted Cruz and Donald Trump. And they're already going into, like, phalangist racial science, where they're like, well, see, we descended from the Mayflower people, and those white people descended from the Scots-Irish people. So, like, they're just, you know, we tried to get all these, you know, all these people who got their brain scrambled in the war, we tried to get them jobs at Cinnabon, and they just don't want to do any better.
You could tell that, you can see in this, the contours of the coming policy debate on the right is really going to be what to do about the underclass. Completely separate from them or actively massacre them all. Like, that's going to be sort of the difference between the reformicons and the hard right. It's like the reformicons are just like, can't we just build a taller wall and maybe put a moat out? And the hard right is going to be like, you pussies, we need to be dropping sarin gas on these places.
I would love to see Jonah Goldberg in a pike helmet in a doom charge in the West Virginia mountains.
I don't think the reformicons...
She's like, just putting... catapulting smallpox blankets into the hollers.
I don't think the reformicons are quite there yet, because sort of in response to Kevin Williamson's,
decor, really.
Yeah, exactly. Again, some of them that were still not ready to give up the ghost, like, you know, David Brooks and Arthur Brooks of, I think he's the head of American
AEI,
Harriet, one of those fucking things. Their prescription now is that just these people need more respect from the sort of like upper classes. That they need more recognition now that they're getting on this intersectional politics shit. They need recognition and affirmation from people who have, you know, been married to the same woman for 30 years. And one of them said, I think we need to, like, you know, shake the hand of the repairman. That was an actual quote. And David Brooks in his column this week was saying, like, you know, I failed in my duties as a reporter because I'd never thought Trump would happen, but that's because I don't socialize with these people. And I'm like, you never will, David. Stop kidding yourself.
You think Applebee's has a salad bar. He literally thinks that.
No, when you go to the soda swimming pool at Ruby Tuesday and you realize as you're getting a classic Coca-Cola zeroed, you realize that the boy who takes out your piss pot, you didn't say, good week, sport, and he's voting for Trump.
Now this,
when you go to the when you go to the Golden Corral for your chocolate enema, you need to make eye contact with the busboy.
Now, I think they're borrowing from their intellectual hero Charles Murray, who came out with a book a couple years ago, Coming yes. Apart, yeah, in which one. He sort of creates this metaphor for about how sort of white America is diverging ever more dramatically on class lines, like, you know, well-off college-educated people basically only hang out with other well-off college-educated people, marry them, and hence, you know, the eugenic cycle begins. And now he created this...
Idiocracy's a freaking documentary.
He created this ridiculous metaphor where, like, of two towns, like, you know, Mayfield and Fishtown or something, which is what these guys always do. They essentially try to pass off fiction as, like, legitimate social and political science. And his prescription is that... like, upper-class people need to do more to instruct their inferiors in how to in these kind of middle-class values. But they've never – like, Ross Douthat has said this. David Brooks has said this. But they never, ever explain how this would actually work.
Well, it's going to start with David and Ross Douthat on a road trip across this country, stopping at across this land and going to, you know, chain restaurants and big box retailers, and just starting conversations.
It's the exact same thing as when Hillary Clinton says, we need to have a national conversation on race. It's the substitute for any policy. They both, like, every neutered person who supports just endless death and destruction and war, but it's just like a little too afraid to just outright say fuck these people. They do love that national conversation language, and they like they think that like things aren't so far gone for them at this point that these people are craving the respect of David Brooks or John Podora. It's like no one even we're the only people who like know who these fucking people
yeah, are. Yeah, yeah. Well, I care more about their opinions.
I have just a gorgeous vision of David Brooks like going to a biker bar in like Indiana and they all think he's a cop and they beat him to death.
I would
we were talking earlier about how this would work, and it was like I'm just trying to imagine Brooks or Duthout, and they're like, yeah, they're at the Golden Corral, and they're just sort of like maybe a nod, maybe a wink, maybe just like you know a stolen glance at like you know some guy sitting across from them, and like this is almost exactly like sort of like cruising. Like it would come across like they were trying to get Cruz or something. Like they were,
and then they would get beaten to death. It all ends with them getting beaten to death. any version of this ends with them getting stomped to death in a big box parking lot.
That's how Larry Craig got caught. Was yes. he was in Washington for so long. He's like, how do I talk to these people again?
Let me just nudge this guy and see if he wants to talk about his paycheck.
Look! You try to reconnect with the white base, you will end up on a podium saying that you've never been gay.
But yeah, we were also saying earlier that if I was one of these horny-handed sons of toil, I would absolutely prefer the open contempt of Kevin D. Williamson to the simpering condescension of David Brooks. There's no question.
You have to give people you hate at least the fucking honor of hating them.
Yep.
Yeah.
I just want to say one more thing about the Williamson piece because it just baffles me about these are the kind of guys who like their big takeaway, their big takedown of any kind of socialist project or left wing vision is always economically illiterate much puppies and rainbows. But Kevin D. Williamson's plan is insane. It's first of all it would be like massive basically an unprecedented degree of turmoil and dislocation. It would be a massive waste of infrastructure you're going to have like giant sections of highway and plumbing and electrical just like fall apart. Is that the idea? And then when all these people move to these cities, what the hell is going to happen to housing?
This is always a good recipe for like social cohesion and democratic vision is when huge masses of like rural peasantry flood into the cities looking for work and
it's like it would basically be like Mumbai with more chilies. I mean, is that they'd be like there would be like improvised chilies in the hovels in the slums, like made with with metal sheeting and cinder blocks. They would like recreate the eateries and folkways of what they remembered from the exurbs they used to live in.
Man, if you think Michael Barbaro is afraid to get on the train now.
Oh my god. The conditions in slum sector Zeta have become dangerous and unacceptable.
You'll need a mech suit. This is ridiculous. The Times has to buy me a Gundam.
Gundams become like it's like a company car for anybody who gets a staff job with any of these media things. I just imagine like a bunch of Applebee's servers in burlap sacks that they have written Applebee's on the front of. But, like, every year the spelling gets a little worse because they're farther away from remembering what it really looked like.
Hey, shit, maybe these guys just really love the Bastard Executioner and more.
I want to be one of those perverted lords who's fucking everybody.
Yeah, they want to be Milas Corbett.
I think actually Milas Corbett is a good analog for Kev Williamson in a lot of ways.
Oh, God. He already looks like he wants to live in a dungeon. Yeah. He just needs to actually get one.
I assume he already does, but yeah.
We're talking about how like he's pointing to himself as this example of success. There's this famous screenshot of like a Skype he did or like a talking head, a blogging heads where you can see his apartment, and it looks like the kind of place where social services would come and they take the kid away.
Oh. Kev, we should get him on the show.
Yeah, we need to talk to Kevin.
I'm sure he'd be great. We need to talk about Kevin.
We need to talk about Kevin. To Kevin.
Yeah.
He is a thin-skinned bitch, which makes him like one of the best ones because like he's still mad at Matt Bruning like a year later for trolling
Matt Bruning fucking ended him.
Like as soon as you're on like you're being recorded for a broadcast to talk about policy or whatever, and you out of nowhere bring up a guy on Twitter who owned you, he's in your head for life.
Yeah, he closes it when he's at like the hot topic that they only have in DC that's for 35 to 60-year-old conservative men.
The big and tall hot topic.
He's like closing his eyes and he's seeing Matt Bruning's Abby and just remembering all the ironic retweets he got.
Yeah. Well, there are a few other things happened this week. We got Obama nominated John Merrick, the Elephant Man, to serve on the Supreme Court, which I thought was he's putting the Republicans in a hard position because they don't want to come across.
They're going to look ableist as hell, yeah.
Yeah, they don't want to come across as ghoulishly mocking this grotesque. You know, I'm just imagining the confirmation hearings are going to be dope, though. I mean, actually, they're not even going to get a confirmation hearings because the moment he just goes, I am not an Edinburgh. He'll get voted on immediately, like just the sympathy vote alone. They can't deny him. So that's why they're trying to deny him the court hearings. But I hope Merrick gets on the Supreme Court. What can I say?
I do think that it's a perfect example of how, at heart, Obama is a fucking logic dork nerd debate guy like Cruz in a lot of ways. Because there was no chance anybody was going to get confirmed, right? Like, at best, you're going to be able to maybe make it an issue to help beat some of these swing state senators, you know, like Kirk and Portman. Like, you're not going to get them confirmed before Obama leaves office. So what does he do? He nominates this guy who has a pretty terrible record on defendants' rights and national security stuff, but guys like Orrin Hatch have said nice things about him. So it's like, excuse me, Senate Republicans, but by your logic, this guy deserves to be on the Supreme Court. QED. Like, anybody cares.
It's
that's going to have any influence on anyone.
I sort of understand why he did it, but, like, I think they totally overestimate, like, they're like, oh, the Republicans are going to look so bad when they, have to. Nobody cares. Nobody cares about that shit.
The Republicans hung out with Ahmed Chalabi and invaded this country and just ruined it and got all these people killed and like poisoned the air. Like, they don't give a fuck.
They just poisoned several thousand people in Flint, Michigan.
Yeah, they poisoned these people. Like, this is going to be the thing that does it. Like, oh my God, I was just getting back from a conference where I listened to Charles Murray talk about how Africans, the shape of their nose causes them to get less oxygen in their brain. But by nominating a judge that I've said nice things about, like, I'm totally not just going to lie or call you a fucking asshole. Like, this. Yeah.
The only people that could conceivably care about this are Washington people. And
exactly.
Again, I sort of, like, I understand what he's doing because, like, the Republicans definitely won't let him get on the Supreme Court, but honestly, the worst thing that could happen, in my opinion, is if they just did let him on the Supreme Court, because this guy seems like a just hack, awful.
Yeah,
he's not good. He seems like a boring. He's like a half a Scalia, basically.
Yeah, he's actually to the right of Scalia on a lot of defendants' rights stuff. So that's good.
Wow,
yeah, that's a hell of an upgrade.
Horrifying to think about.
Yeah.
Another quick hit from the week was at the beginning. Our beautiful boy Ben Shapiro angrily resigned from his tenure at Breitbart. It's the end of an era, folks.
No, Ben. No,
Ben. No.
Mourn you till I join you, player. I'm pouring out some Yoo-Hoo on the black for you, boy.
I saw a video by the that Ben Drive has produced in his garage this week, where he puts all the tweets from the alt-right guys up there who are like, I'm going to kill you, you kike faggot. Okay. He's like, look, another anti-Semitic tweet from a Trump supporter.
Like, but Shapiro, and by the way, you called him Ben Dreyfus, which is funny.
Oh, what?
Shapiro tries to court them, too. He tries to play it off like he's just like, hey, alt-right guys, take it from your favorite Jew. Like.
That's why he's mad. He hates Milo, because Milo's like their official gay guy,
And by hate Milo, it means like I'm obsessed with him. Jacks off thinking about him. Right. Something I found out reading about this is that Ben Shapiro's father also wrote for Breitbart under a pseudonym, William Bigelow. And his father also left Breitbart. His dad had to leave Breitbart, too. And this is funny. Joel Pollack, the guy who used to be best friends with Ben, friendship with Pollack ended. Again, look up Joel Pollack. He's another goggle-eyed Muppet. But Pollack put the only mention of her departure, Michelle Fields, this is what kicked it all off, in the last line of an article he had written, and under the pseudonym William Bigelow, a name used by Shapiro's father, David, and quoted himself in it. But it goes on to say, David Shapiro resigned from Breitbart on Sunday evening, according to Politico. Pollack's article was illustrated with an image of a baby snake hatching, a picture lifted from a Facebook of a happy-looking Fields playing a game with Trump brand playing cards, and tags that included traitors, urine, jihad, and baby snake.
These guys are turning into Little Chapo. They're going to start releasing diss tracks of each other.
These streets are scour out there.
But, I'm looking at Joel Pollack right now, and it looks like if Beaker from The Muppets was real and a date rapist.
I've never seen this guy. Let me look him up right now.
He's horrifying.
Well, there's one quote I have to read. This is my favorite thing ever written about the Breitbart boys. This is from Mark Ames' piece about him. It's one of my favorite lines ever. He says, Pollack and Shapiro both harbor deluded fantasies of becoming the telegenic faces and voices of the conservative movement. The only thing holding them back, their faces and voices.
Joe Pollack looks like if Jeremy Scahill took a bath in chemotherapy every day.
But the best line from Ben's resignation is he says, quote, Andrew's life mission has been betrayed.
What is Trump anti-Coke now?
And yes. I love the idea that Ben is going to carry on Andrew's legacy by what? Immediately gaining 200 pounds, getting a drug addiction, and then dying after walking up a hill?
Inshallah.
I read this thing by some other like Breitbart guy who's, they just all blend together, who was like, Andrew was too charismatic, and he got a lot of people on board, and it caused the death of his websites once he died. Andrew could stand out on a street corner and build a movement around him. Well, look, Andrew Breitbart lay dead in a gutter in L.A. for like 4 hours, and I didn't see any fucking movement build around his body corpse.
I guess, trying to get a wince to get him into the fucking ambulance.
I mean, I guess the like five people that congregated around his rotting, bloated corpse that had half of Bogota in his ear, nose, and throat, it did become like the core of the Ted Cruz presidential
explorer. But now they're all turning against each other, and it's pretty fun to watch. But
that's been the best thing about Trump, has been watching the revolution eat its children. It's been amazing.
I love watching John Podoretz, because John Podoretz gets every day like people like, Keck, LOL, 1488. Fuck you, you kike piece of shit. I'm going to kill your kid and put you in an oven. And he quotes it, and he's like, guess I won't be seeing you at the opera. I really got them, fucking moron who's neurotically replying to everybody for 14 hours, you stupid fat fuck.
Okay. Pivoting off the alt-right, I said one last story from this week that, this is a random one, but I thought it was amazing. This is from Haaretz, the Israeli paper. This is just the headline here. Pro-Israel robot harasses students at Brown. I mean, need I read any more? The headline's already gold.
Wait, somebody forgot to unplug Avi Meyer?
Okay, it says, a robot operating on behalf of the pro-Israel advocacy group Stand With Us has been accused of harassing students at the Ivy League Brown University. After it attended a discussion of the Israel-Palestine conflict, the incident, the debating cyborg, operated by one of the right-wing group's directors, Shahar Azani, was accused of policing academic discourse. The contraption, an iPad on wheels, Azani was able to move himself around the room and discuss with students, which included individuals from the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. So it was like an iPad on a Segway with like a Skype chat of this guy going, this is anti-Semitic, or Philip K. Dickstein is what I thought of when I
this is what all the Sheldon Adelson money is getting. It's getting like a Segway with an iPad on it going, bleep, boop, why don't they go to Jordan?
It also shows how futsy these little Ivy Leaguers are, because like somebody, if I've got an iPad on a Segway rolling up to me going like, eh, excuse me.
Steal the iPad.
Just fucking kick it over. Zionism, that's code for anti-Semitism. It's like, good, well, I'm going to push you downstairs now.
I'm just gonna start playing Candy Crush on your face right now.
I would be playing fucking Future right on that thing, or pulling a Monster Energy drink on that. Fucking nerds.
Sorry, I just when I read this story, I'm just gonna put on my alt-right hat for a second and react to this story as one of Ben Shapiro's detractors, and just say the Jew often uses surrogates to fight on their behalf.
This robot is kind of like the wet dream of like woke Twitter guys, because they fantasize about being in a food court and a robot rolling up to them, and they can do a real life period at reply.
I can imagine that they would love to commandeer the robot and then like patrol through the cafeteria and call out people for cultural appropriation and their meal choice without the threat of getting their ass kicked.
You think that's one thing the robot does? Like if it sees people eating falafel, it's like, beep boop, that was invented by Israelis, it's an Israeli food.
I just want this thing to start following around Ali Abu Nima everywhere it goes. oh, fuck me. God, these were our minor topics to discuss this week.
One last thing: if it hears a John Legend song, it goes, "Go back to playing the piano." Stop making your opinions, boy. Really, Poteritz's personality was implanted on that fucking thing.
Whenever you yell at it, a picture of his dumb kid pops up to try to deflect it, so you lay off.
Do you think the conservative... I'm sorry, we're going way too long on this, but I love the topic. Do you think the conservative robots are, like, the actual conservatives, and that they just, like, haplessly get stuck in places, too?
It's like the Ed 209 from RoboCop. It can't go downstairs. That's its biggest weakness.
Code 39.
And if you walk down the stairs to get away from it, it's like, oh, I see. Not willing to engage in a
dead or alive debate.
Typical...
Dead or alive,
you've proven my point
to Tel Aviv.
Reading comprehension fail.
Someone create a parody Twitter account for the pro-Israel robot right now.
I mean, it's a failure if it hasn't already been made, frankly. Come on. Get on it, people.
Okay, so that was. I think we covered everything that happened in the world this week. That was great.
Yeah.
So... we promised it at the beginning of the show. This is our plan. We have to discuss the phenomenon that is Hamilton the musical, and basically, Lowen Chafin did another Medium article on this. I'm gonna sort of borrow from him. It was titled "Why You Should Be Terrified That People Who Enjoy Hamilton Run Our Country." And I gotta say, I agree with him 100%. And by the way, Lowen has been killing it with these Medium pieces. He's just been spitting acid in every one of them, and I love them. But the genesis of this discussion this week, this could be a running segment on this show called "What Nauseated You the Most This Week?" And for me, it was easily David Roberts, aka Dr. Vox of Vox, his series of tweets about Hamilton and his passion.
Because the cast, or at least the head guy, the writer creator. Were at the White House.
Yeah, Lin-Manuel Miranda went to the White House this week, and David Roberts reacted. He goes, this is all caps right now. He says, "Hamilton being performed live at the White House here. I'm so effing excited." And then it's starting now, Hamilton, White House, it's all happening. This is an adult man.
Dude, just fucking kill yourself. Fucking so, take a header off the top. Okay,
the dude's looking at his computer like Nelson watching Andy Williams in Branson, Missouri.
Here's the best part about it. When, of course, people... Because Dr. Vox is despicable. He looks
Who is this guy? God.
He looks like if Jonah Goldberg was run through a carpet cleaner. but he's just like the biggest neoliberal centrist pussy in the world. But like people like regularly abuse this guy and are like, shut up, you fucking pussy. I'm going to fuck your wife. You're retarded. Fuck you. And he's like, I see you've conceded my point. You've run out of arguments. but when people were like, of course, replied to him like, Hamilton sucks, it's for children, it's Schoolhouse Rock, you're a bitch, shut the fuck up. He was like, my day is ruined learning that they're Hamilton haters on Twitter.
No, that's what sent him over the edge. There was just two more. When he said, the very first time Aunt Lin-Manuel quietly sings the word Alexander Hamilton, I got a tear in my eye. It's Pavlovian. Okay, this is the worst one. I can't say exactly why, but to me, Hamilton represents everything about America that Trump isn't. Oh,
that makes me want to give money.
He doesn't want it, but I want to give it to him. I want to give Trump $500.
Yeah,
I want him to become president and then spend 20 minutes of the first State of the Union calling Dr. Vox a bitch.
Yeah, I want Trump to like make a speech about how much Hamilton sucks.
Yeah, no, I would vote for him if he did that.
Cash, I would vote better.
Look at them. What are they doing? They're rapping. They're dressed up like pirates. So, what's going on? Absurd.
So now we exposed ourselves to it this week, I'm issuing a challenge now to everyone listening to the show. Find the Hamilton original soundtrack. See if you can get some clips of it. Find the original soundtrack. See how long you can listen to any one of these songs. If you can make it more than 10 to 15 seconds, then you've beaten me.
Hamilton is like something that Dennis, like a scheme that Dennis would have on Always Sunny.
The thing that I've always, as soon as I just want to pat myself on the back a little bit, in that like this has been a phenomenon for a while now, and it's been gaining steam, especially certainly in New York and among the pundit and media class, like they've been loving this thing, like over the fall and winter, the BuzzFeed Hamilton Slack is a thing I found out existed. And it filled me with despair. But I was on record 6 months ago saying anyone who paid hundreds of dollars to go to Broadway to watch the Founding Fathers rap should be jailed and all of their assets confiscated.
The BuzzFeed people should be taken on a one-way helicopter trip over the ocean.
We were getting very dark now in our hatred of this, but I'll say the worst part about it is like, okay, it's the rapping Founding Fathers, everybody. But here's the worst part: the rapping in this musical is the worst kind of rapping that every like dickhead like white kid teenager who tries to become a rapper does. It's the same style where you take the same word and it's all this. It's like, I'm talking about the devastation the corporations cause across our nation. It's like it's not even rapping. It's just cheating. It's just
that's rich kid rap. That's fucking
like
slightly above backpack rap.
Yeah.
These people fucking love it because they want to be intersectional, but if you're Dr. Vox, you're still like terrified of black people. Like Dr. Vox is he probably locks his doors when he sees black people, even though he lives in a nice neighborhood and nothing's ever fucking happened to him in his life. But he wants to be like, I like all music. Finally a musical came along performed by like art kids where they're like, yo, if the fiscal responsibility creates a disparity, then we will have parity for our parity. He's like, ah, yes, nice. Okay.
You know, I didn't like rap, but then when people started doing it in powdered wigs, I felt myself oddly comforted.
It's just there's a song on the Hamilton soundtrack called the Ten Dual Commandments. That's obviously a riff on the famous Ten Crack Commandments.
One of the greatest rap songs of all.
Probably one of the best rap songs ever written. But it's all stuff like rule number two: get yourself a second. That's two. He's your lieutenant. Like And it's just, oh, these people love it. They like, it's become a phenomenon in our, and then Emma Watson beatboxes with Lin-Manuel about feminism, and it's just like,
I think
how that's like that's anyone, part of what appeals, this is the corniest shit ever.
I think what appeals to it, because like I did listen to the first song, the one, and it's now in my head, and I wish I could fucking stick a knitting needle in my eye and get rid of it.
Yeah.
And the very first line is, "How does a bastard, orphan, child of a whore and a Scotsman?" And it's all about like this guy who, because apparently that's what drew Lin-Manuel Miranda to it, is this guy was a poor immigrant who came to America and became the Secretary of the Treasury and helped shape this country. And so it's really that, it is the ideal world as conceived of by these limp dick media people and pundits, a government system where you have a meritocracy that is multicultural, right?
Yeah.
Like they want to feel like everyone has a chance, but like the best people can rise and be successful like Alexander Hamilton was. And then that vision of government in the Founding Fathers, like what Dr. Vox is talking about, the opposite of Trump, this idea of like people of merit coming together and doing what's best for the country on its own terms without either the pressure of actual voters and actual citizens, the great beast, as Alexander Hamilton actually called them, on the one side, and then the depressing reality of the actual interest groups that shape policy on the other. Like those two things that sort of bipartisan centrist fantasy of government likes to get rid of. And when they close their eyes and imagine government, there aren't people baying for blood. There aren't, you know, the great beast, and there isn't just cold capital making the shots. There are people speaking from the heart, smart people. But and so that founding father vision of those guys sitting around, you know, the cabinets making these decisions, that's very inspiring to them. But you know, because they're liberals, they're made uncomfortable by the fact they're all white slave owners. So by turning that into a multicultural rap battle, it's like that they get to pretend to be cool and nerdy, and they get to imagine this system of government, this elite brokerage through, you know, cool, to them anyway, multicultural hip-hop.
And this is sort of like why Dr. Vox, when people just started making fun of him, he was like, "I never block anyone, but these Hamilton trolls. I mean, once you love something, there's always going to be like, you know, some douche to come along to shit on it." It's like they invest so much in their sort of like personal tastes in popular culture. It's like it's really important to them, and it's, I don't know, it's like it's this nerd culture thing.
Yeah, like, it's informative nerdiness. Like everybody, the thing now online is to perform some variety of nerdiness, you know, and it's either like Game of Thrones or I fucking love science or superhero movies. And for these guys who are ostensibly supposed to care about government and politics and stuff, this is a chance to be performatively nerdy.
These people don't have any actual politics outside of respecting the rules and wearing lanyards and respecting the people in power.
And these guys were all
not only that, but as Lowen, as the point Lowenschaffen makes in his Medium article, which I highly recommend you all look up, because I think at one point he says Lin-Manuel is the least talented person to get invited to the White House since the kid who took apart a clock. but a point he makes in that is that all of this elides the actual politics of Alexander Hamilton, which would be totally anathema to the kind of Vox neoliberal mindset, because he was completely he was anti-free trade, basically.
Yeah,
he was anti-free trade, but the thing they probably do respond to, and I haven't listened to all of the songs, but it certainly comes through in a basic perusing of Hamilton, is his just virulent elitism.
Right.
They would get down with that. They wouldn't get down with the protectionism, but they definitely get down with the people are a great beast, especially after they get called a lame-o on Twitter for 20 minutes.
This is the same thing as the woke people who are like,
I listen to artists called Beyonce because they have no policy, and they're just all cultural signifiers. It's almost like monarchism, where they've picked an idol to represent them. But these, like, the Dr. Vox people, they're supposed to be the policy wonks, but they're just as fucking shallow and fetid as anyone else, because this nothing has represented them more. Like a hagiographical musical where they can pretend to be intersectional and pretend to be multicultural.
One of the other great tweets about it was from Elise Foley, who's the politics and immigration reporter for the HuffPo. She said, "Idea: democratic debate, but in the style of the cabinet rap battles from Hamilton."
Yes.
Oh my.
Yes.
Oh fuck you. What's Hillary?
It's like, politics are okay, but I need them, yes, to be more intersectional. I need them to be to have some patina of performative nerdiness, and I want a politics that's devoid of policy. I want it to be won by rhymes, basically cleverness. It's basically a recapitulation of the West Wing fetish, where the guy with the best epic Sorkin monologue wins. The guy with the best hip hop rhyme wins.
Bernie's gonna have a really problematic rap.
Bernie's gonna use the N word.
Bernie featuring Piss Man. Females, listen up. Think it in the air.
I mean, again, I don't know. I think, I mean, I am already biased against musicals as a genre, but this is just, I mean, like. Again, just try to listen to one of these songs, and really, I
do love the idea though that these guys have that this thing is it's like it's educational. It's a way to instill values. Like we were talking earlier about all of these people, these pundit types fretting about the dislocated and antisocial lower classes, and I just imagine them like deciding to bring Hamilton to the people. Like going before a Trump rally and doing a performance of Hamilton to try to instill democratic values in them. Hey, he was an immigrant too, everybody. And they get the response that the performance of Uncle Tom's Cabin got from the nativists and gangs of New York.
It's also not educational, though, because it's not accurate. It's
no, that was what was crazy. I listened to one of the cabinet rap battles, God help me. And at one point, Jefferson is talking about, you know, if we got so mad about a tax on tea, what if it's a tax on whiskey? Oh! And it's like, the Boston Tea Party wasn't about a tea. It was about mercantilism, and it was about the East India Company monopoly, you know? It's like, it's literally not even giving you good information in its terrible, awkward, shitty raps.
The East India Company monopoly is on top of me. This has got to start the dichotomy.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, you could write Hamilton, too. You could write
that's the other thing, is that somebody wrote
it's kind of hard to do a sequel because, you know, he got bucked. He got
the next one. The next one is going to be Monroe. If something happens in your
the next one should be Andrew Jackson.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what? The funny thing is that there was a Jackson musical a few years ago. It was way less successful.
There was.
Huh. Bloody Andrew Jackson. I actually saw that with my in-laws.
How was that?
It was terrible. Oh, it was garbage.
God.
They didn't rap. The one good thing about it is they didn't rap. But yeah, that ran for like 1 year, like 3 or 4 years ago, so there can't be an Andrew Jackson one.
Okay.
But apparently the new thing online, first it was a bunch of people offering suggestions for what his follow-up should be, and now there are annoying, like, outraged people going, stop telling Lin-Manuel Miranda what he should finish, how he should follow up Hamilton.
Okay.
He'll do it on his own. He'll do it in his own time, sir.
The General Westmoreland story?
Ooh. How about a plucky young soldier who became the captured a nation's imagination? It's called Cali.
Yeah, no. People thought he was too much of a sort of low class cretin to be an officer, but he proved them wrong.
Yeah, that's right.
Count as a moron, idiot.
Never got a commission. I'm the New York Times now.
I think he could do the Sand Creek Massacre. That would be a good one.
Yeah. The Lindy England musical. Point him out. Point him out.
I dreamed a dream in time gone by. Iraqis would be made to die.
I think an Ahmed Chalabi musical would.
An Ahmed Chalabi movie, any adaptation of the there needs to be a biopic about him.
A Chalabi movie would be fucking awesome.
It would be really, really good if it was done with the sense of humor that you would need to, like, if it was done like the Tim Burton Ed Wood movie, it would be amazing.
It would have to be that or like the Coen brothers. We should write it. We should write the fucking Ahmed Chalabi movie.
Yes. We absolutely should.
Let's crowdsource this to the Chapo fan base. You know, it'll be like a
collaborative. Just remember, though, there's going to have to be several rap songs, just so everyone knows.
Well, Eli Lake is very important to this story, so of course.
That's true. So he will have like after they've had like a lunch at, you know, Signatures or something, he'll break out into a rap.
Oh, God, like, that is what Hamilton is like. Hamilton, the lyrics in Hamilton are like Eli Lake and Rehan Salam's rap tweets. They're exactly.
Oh, my God, that's totally true.
It's that level of just...
I hope we're not giving him...
...inducing awfulness.
I hope they're not giving them an idea to write their own rap musical.
About
the Surge or something.
Yeah,
the Moza.
Fallujah with exclamation point. We drop in white phosphorus. We prosperous. We got this.
Oh, God.
I'm awakening an ambar. We've gone too far.
It's just called, it's called O Fallujah with an exclamation point. All right. This is actually, I've actually made myself sick thinking about this. This is honestly like rotted my soul over this last hour and 10, 15 minutes.
You shouldn't listen to this. I'm realizing now you shouldn't listen to this.
Yeah, nobody listen to this podcast.
Werner Herzog would destroy these tapes.
Delete it.
Yeah, you're saying you must not listen to this. This is a podcast that is beyond sanity.
Again, to that end, I guess as if we haven't been nice enough over the course of the last hour or so, I'd like to close out the show today with what I hope will be a weekly feature called Chapo Death Threats, where we make satirical threats of violence to a certain person who has annoyed us during the week. And now I want to make very clear, I know it's not okay, you generally shouldn't explain a joke, but I just want to make very clear that I am inhabiting a character when I do this, and the joke is that this person is so unwell that they've elevated minor annoyances with D-list media figures into poisonous vendettas. And I just want to be clear, that is not who we are, and I think that should be obvious. So, starting this week's edition, Ben Dreyfuss, homie, when I see you, oh my God, I'm going to put you in a hospital bed. I'm a what about Bob you brisk iced tea drinking fake journalist.
Ben Dreyfuss, check the back tattoo. It says Celtic Warrior because basically I took so much fucking damage in the fight with Mike McGregor that they said, oh my God, who is this crazy white boy? Basically, I would pretend to be Muhammad Ali in there. No shit. Speak on it, Chad Zawalik. And I would fucking humiliate you. Oh, my God. I would clown you. I'd be stepping back, let you throw punches on me, man. And I'd get all spun on Stevie and weed. And then I would basically, in a fucking level 5 situation, turn you into my girlfriend.
Listen up, Ben Dreyfuss. I know you're sad about being a journalist and not an actor. I feel that. But, homie, I'm going to take you to a country and western bar. I'm going to fill you with tequila. I'm going to put you on the mechanical bull. And I'm not going to let you off until you puke your guts out. And everyone's going to be laughing. and pointing at you and taking vines and shit to put online, and then you're going to be in the hospital for dehydration.
All kidding aside, Ben Dreyfuss, quit your job. You're not a journalist. You make Mia Farrow and Frank Sinatra's kid look good by comparison.
Just live in your dad's basement. It's fine. You can still tweet.
Can I have $8,000?
Yeah, could you sponsor our podcast, Ben Dreyfuss? We were just kidding.
He might do it too, out of self-loathing.
We were just kidding. We like you.
Yeah, we like.
No, that's not gonna work. We gotta Vindom him. That will work because he's so filled with self-loathing. That if we're like, you little piece of shit, you worthless,
you
taking
fucking,
up space
you
motherfucker.
Fucking worm, you fucking you got, worm. Our you, wish list is in the bio.
You nepotistic slime bag. You couldn't make it as an actor, even though you're Richard Dreyfuss's kid. Meanwhile, Colin frickin' Hanks made it as an actor.
Chet Hayes made it as a rapper.
Yeah, you're not as good as Colin Hanks. You need to make up for the fact that you exist by paying us.
Sponsor our podcast, Ben.
Yeah, please.
Amazon wish list.
Amazon wish list in the bio. And just as a final programming note, I'd just like to make clear that we are now available on Stitcher. And the only reason we're not available on iTunes yet is that they have some incredibly stringent requirement for the number of pixels that are allowed in your icon that I just saw and my eyes glazed over. So if you'd like us on iTunes and are good at that kind of thing, hit me up in the DMs. We want to get this out to as many people as possible. We've had a great response so far. And it's been great. So please share us. Please like us. Please review us. I'm very insecure. So till next week, guys.
Peace.
Peace out.